The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon, Eastern Daylight Time, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on what can we do to replace the flu shot. Got some good ideas there. Also, what happens to our body when we slow down how we take food in, how we eat, slow eating. Give you the latest from the staff writers of Seed Daily. Something good there also. Going to give you the latest on Frankenfoods. As you know, we are but one of dozens of organizations working together with one common goal: educate the American public about the dangers of Frankenfoods, genetically modified foods. At the very least, let's get them labeled. If we do that, I guess 95% of the American population will not buy it, which case it'll go out of business. But we're getting heard, and I'll give you the latest of why. Our guest will be a newsmaker guest. It will be a short guest piece. He is Jim Gerritsen, and he is the owner of the Wood Prairie Farm in Bridgewater, Maine, where he's grown organic seed for over 35 years. He's president of the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association. And we're going to talk about a lawsuit on behalf of 270,000 organic and family farmers against Monsanto's patent claims for genetically modified seeds, fighting back against the absolute villain of American greed, so as manifest in Monsanto. Anyhow, that's that. Our issue of the day will be dealing with taxes. And I'm going to start with America's corporate tax problems and the average individual's tax problems and why our system simply doesn't work and can't the way it's structured. But what it could be done, and I'll give you some ideas, and then I'll ask you to call in and share your points of view. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. I believe that we should be taking probiotics every day, because it helps establish healthy bacteria. We also know that it is far more than just having some good bacteria and bad bacteria. We now know that bacteria communicate with one another and can migrate throughout the body. And our thoughts can directly impact whether we have principally and primarily good or bad bacteria working for or against us. So why not have more good bacteria? Now, Lynn Saputo, who we've had on this program, who is a physician, writes this. It's short, but I thought it's interesting. Can probiotics replace the flu shot? We now know the real reason why children hospitalized with swine flu have been at risk for dying. It's not because of the swine flu virus itself. Most of them contracted methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA, infections that they passively harbored in their nasal passages before contracting the swine flu. And while swine flu itself can cause death, it is far less common than when MRSA is present, about 800% less common. Most children with MRSA pneumonias have been carriers of MRSA. Their MRSA pneumonias are not hospital-acquired infections most of the time. What would happen if these swine flu-infected children were no longer carriers of MRSA? Would they be at a far lower risk of developing MRSA pneumonias and dying from them? You bet. Is there a way to get rid of MRSA that so often colonized the nasal passages? Yes, indeed. Would it work as well as the swine flu vaccine? Possibly. Because of the overuse of antibiotics, we're seeing the rise of microbes such as MRSA and C. difficile in the normal flora of healthy people. These microbes, although potentially lethal, do not make sufficient quantities of toxins to make us sick unless they overgrow and are present in sufficient volume. However, when we become ill and our resistance is low, these microbes then begin to overgrow, produce large amounts of endotoxin, and create the disastrous consequences we hear about. Wouldn't it be interesting if we could markedly reduce the numbers of these microbes when people are healthy? Probiotics are now being used in mainstream medicine to control the microflora of both the gut and the vagina. Why couldn't we use probiotics in a nasal spray to displace MRSA and C. difficile? This would be a novel way to crowd out these potentially dangerous microbes. We could lower the risk of death from MRSA in children with swine flu who are in the ICU by 800% by chasing out MRSA and C. difficile from the nasopharynx by using probiotics. So that's his thoughts. So what he's really saying is that many children carry MRSA in their nasal area, and that means they can migrate up into the cavities, the sinus cavities. And it means that they've been given way too many antibiotics, and hence they become antibiotic resistant. Now, then all it requires is some, you know, lack of sleep, some stress, some shock, and then the body tips and goes into a state where normal homeostasis, a normal biochemical balance, cannot exist, and that's when a person gets sick. Think how many times people have been okay and then had an argument. The very next morning, they wake up with a sore throat. They didn't contract anything during the night. It's just that the normal viruses and bacteria that reside in the body then shifted because of the thought and hormones that we put into that mixture to a pathological state. So we should start looking at getting probiotic sprays. They do exist. Putting them into the nasal cavities, just spraying in the nasal cavities, but also at the same time, increasing the amount of probiotics in the diet. Put them in a drink. Have maybe a probiotic drink two or three times a day. I can tell you that virtually everyone I work with, I'm suggesting probiotics because it's just one very good way to reestablish a healthier intestinal flora. We should be taking our time eating. We should eat with joy. Too many people, however, use the dinner table as a virtual fighting arena. Arguments, everything that's wrong comes out because you've got a captive audience. It's terrible for digestion. It's not good at all for helping you assimilate the nutrients that are supposed to be in the food and for you to even aesthetically enjoy the food. How can you enjoy food if you're having some determinist discussion about something? You're going to be stressed. That's why I believe you should always relax, put on soothing music, create as nice of an environment you can. And for myself, I like to eat in silence. I almost never talk, unless I'm out with friends. Yes, but otherwise, I just prefer silence. No television, no radio, and take your time. Now, this is very common all over the world, except in England and in the United States. Two new studies by researchers at the University of Rhode Island, according to the staff writers of Seed Daily, are providing additional insights into the role that eating at a certain pace plays in the amount of food one consumes. The studies found that men eat significantly faster than women, heavier people eat faster than slimmer people, and refined grains, well, that would be like a bagel or bread, are consumed faster than whole grains. Kathleen Mendelson, associate professor of nutrition, found that in a study which validated this, that people who are eating any kind of food are eating at a certain pace. And if they slow down, put the fork down, put the spoon down, they'll simply eat slower. That means they're going to have less caloric intake. That means they're going to have less disease and live longer, because the one thing that all of science agrees upon is that when you reduce calories, you extend the lifespan. From the British Journal of Urology International, erectile dysfunction increases with use of multiple medications. In this study, they reviewed the medical records of 37,000 ethnically diverse men from Southern California and found that those taking the most medications had the highest level of erectile dysfunction. Now, when you this is something men never spoke about. First, because every man growing up feels very uncomfortable talking about their own sex. You rarely hear them discussing this. They keep things to themselves, and especially if they have any kind of erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation, two things men rarely talk about and hence rarely get help for. And that's why Viagra was such an enormous hit when it came out. Who knew that so many people were affected? Here's what it says, that if you're taking three medications, you have a 20% erectile dysfunction. Well, three medications for the average man between the ages, in this study, it was between the ages of 44, which is not old at all, and 65, that's what the average guy would take, unfortunately, not people in the health field. Well, that means 20% are going to suffer from erectile dysfunction, but it goes up to 30% when you get above six a day. So why not look at it differently? Why not say, what can we do naturally to prevent men having to take these medications in the first place? Can we prevent these conditions? The vast majority, yes. Can we treat them naturally? You bet. I'm opposed to virtually all chemotherapy. I'm not opposed to surgery. Surgery can be a lifesaver. Radiation in specific instances can be important. I challenge chemotherapy. I've just completed writing a major report on chemotherapy. I'll be sharing it with you in the next week or two. I believe it's one of the greatest medical frauds ever. And I challenge scientists working in the field to justify the hundreds of billions of dollars, the millions upon millions of lives that have been lost because people had absolute trust in this chemotherapy. Here's just one more reason why I believe it's one of the worst medical frauds in history. This is from Dr. Sheila Kessler and her colleagues at the Stanford University School of Medicine and published in a major peer-reviewed journal. Let me report this. Quote, new evidence chemotherapy for breast cancer causes brain damage. From S.L. Baker, Natural News. Primary breast cancer, and that means, by the way, a breast malignancy that hasn't yet spread to other parts of the body, isn't usually thought of as causing neurological problems. After all, if cancer hasn't spread to the brain, why would it? Researchers have been forced to wonder about the answer to that question because a growing body of evidence, according to Baker, over the past several years strongly suggests that women with breast cancer are at an increased risk not only of other problems with brain function, but with actual alterations to their brain structure. Turns out, according to a report just published in the current issue of Archives of Neurology, that it's not the cancer, but the treatment. Let me repeat that. It is not the cancer, but the treatment for breast cancer, specifically chemotherapy, that could be causing a significant amount of the neurological impairment with poor outcomes seen in women with breast cancer. And then it goes on to talk about the investigation of the patterns of brain activation differed between breast cancer survivors who were treated with chemotherapy and those who were treated without chemotherapy. And the research team also compared the brain activity of these breast cancer survivors to the brain activity of healthy women who were cancer-free. In all, the study looked at the breast cancer, and what they found was statistically significant. And, quote, women with breast cancer demonstrated significantly reduced activation in the left middle prefrontal cortex and premotor cortex compared with healthy controls, the authors reported in the paper. The chemotherapy group also demonstrated significantly reduced left caudal lateral prefrontal cortex activation and increased preservation errors and reduced processing speed compared to other two groups, unquote. So in just lay language, plain English, what does this mean? It means that the researchers concluded that primary breast cancer may cause measurable brain damage from chemotherapy. All right. That's the latest on that. Now, one more insight from genetic engineering. And this is from greenmedinfo.com. I'll quote this. Gamma irradiated virus sprayed frankenfoods. Quote, there is a profound misunderstanding in the mass market today about the value of certified organic food. The question is not whether the 30% or more you pay at the register for an organic product is really worth the added vitamin, mineral, phytonutrient content you receive, even though organic food does usually have considerably higher nutrient density. It is not always the positive quality of what it contains that makes it special. Rather, it is what you know the organic food does not contain, or what has not happened to it on its journey to your table. That makes buying organic a no-brainer to the educated consumer. Let me explain. The FDA presently supports and actively promotes the use of cobalt-60, culled from nuclear reactors, as a form of electronic pasteurization on every domestically produced conventional food. The use of euphemisms like food additive or pasteurization to describe the process of blasting food with high levels of gamma radiation cannot obviate the fact that the very same death rays generated by thermonuclear warfare to destroy life are now being applied to food, supposedly to make it safer. This sort of Orwellian logic, war is peace, is the bread and butter of the state-sponsored industry propaganda. This is not a hypochondriac's rantings, as we're talking about here, but small amounts of radiation. The level of gamma radiation used starts at 1 kilogray. That's equivalent to 16,700,000 chest x-rays, or 333 times the human lethal dose, and goes all the way up from there to 500 million chest x-rays, or 10,000 times lethal dose. And then it goes through how often they're given this. When you buy conventional food, there's little assurance that it has not been irradiated. Although labeling requirements specify that irradiated food sold in stores should have the international symbol, the radara affixed to it, oversight is particularly poor in this regard, and restaurant food and processed food containing irradiated ingredients are not legally required to be labeled as such. Labeled or not, irradiated food is exposed to the same ionizing gamma radiation that destroyed life in Hiroshima and Chernobyl. Primitive life forms like microbes refuse to ingest radiation food, but humans are gullible enough to believe industry pundits and government authorities like the USDA and the FDA, who say doses of radiation applied to your food up to and quite close to a billion chest x-rays are worth ionizing radiation, is safe for human consumption. It's not. The increased sterilization or stabilization and reduction in perishability provided by food irradiation supports the continued globalization of food production and distribution, furthering the agendas of profitability of the transnational corporations who respect for sovereignty, constitutional rights, and public health in the USA are non-existent. And finally, the military-industrial complex requires that the public perceive nuclear energy as not just an element of war or potential ecological disaster, but as something beneficial that may protect us from harm. Nuclear waste, once the irrepressible hodgepodge of nuclear energy industry is done, is suddenly transformed under the guidance and support of our government into both a profitable commodity and a therapeutic agent. But it isn't. In the same way that irradiating bacteria contaminated food does nothing to remove the unsanitary processes that cause the underlying problem, the FDA passed, without any public review or oversight, the use of bacteriophage virus cocktails to be sprayed on meat in an attempt to prevent Listeria monocytogenes outbreaks. This bacteria-specific viruses, in theory, lay dormant, waiting for virulent antibiotic-resistant bacteria upon which they prey. Although the FDA only approves the use of lysic bacteriophages, which are not believed to alter the DNA of the cells they infect, the possibility of contamination with lysogenic strains, which can alter DNA, is significant, owing to the fact that these viruses are only 20 to 200 millionths of a millimeter in size. The FDA's decision to define bacteriophages as, quote, genetically recognized as safe, or generically recognized as safe food additives is premature and therefore a red flag to those who are concerned about the underlying food safety. So, did you know that when you eat meat, that without your knowledge and without seeing it, they had sprayed a lysic bacteriophage onto that? You didn't know that. Bacteriophage virus cocktail sprayed on meat? One more reason why we should not have any genetic engineering of our food. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Men meet those dancing feet on the avenue I'm taking you to. 42nd Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet.
I also really enjoyed that particular Broadway play, 42nd Street. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Now let's go to our issue of the day, and I'm going to put this out there for you to think on and call us and give us your response, please. This originally is from Andrew Leonard, and here's what he says. A new report about companies' finances won't just enrage you, it'll make you run to the nearest protest. And here's what it says. Verizon Corporation reported an annual profit last year of $12 billion. The statutory federal corporate income tax rate is 35%. So theoretically, Verizon should have owed the IRS $4.2 billion. Instead, according to figures compiled by Center for Tax Justice, the company actually boasted a negative tax liability, meaning a refund, of $703 million. Verizon ended up making even more money after it calculated its taxes. Verizon is hardly alone and isn't even close to being the worst offender. Perhaps most famously, General Electric raked in $10 billion in profit, yet ended up reporting $4.7 billion worth of negative taxes, the worst offender in last year, as measured by its overall negative tax rate, was Pepco, the electricity utility that serves Washington, D.C. Pepco reported profits of $881 million and negative taxes of $508 million, a negative tax rate of 57%. So, but those are just examples. So reading through this report, you find yourself seized by an irresistible desire to hurl yourself headlong into the nearest Occupy Your Local City protest. Now, here is the issue. And I'm looking at the larger dynamic of this. The tax code in the United States is simply a completely worthless document. It's almost 60,000 pages. Companies hire the best accountants they can find with the intent of them making the maximum profit and paying little or no taxes. And as you see in many of these cases, not only paying no taxes, actually getting tax refunds or tax carry-forward credits. That means that a lot of Americans don't pay any taxes. The poor and many of the working class pay no taxes. So it leaves a relatively small number of people who actually pay taxes. Now, many very wealthy people pay taxes, but their accountants get them to pay the minimum amount of taxes. And because they make so much money, even that minimum amount is still substantial, but it's still a small percentage. The people who are almost never given a break and have to pay full taxes are the small business owners, and they're double taxed. They're taxed on the taxes that come in when they earn their money in a store, then they're taxed again when they take any of that money as profit or income for themselves at the end of the year on a weekly basis. Double taxation. So, what about this idea? One flat business tax, meaning every company in the United States, no matter what its size, can have no deductions, no accountants, no IRS. Instead, they pay one flat tax. Let's say that tax is somewhere between 15 and 20%. That's lower than what it is now, but if everyone paid it and no one could have any deductions and any money you made offshore was also included, that would generate, according to my figures, and I'm willing to put them up for people to examine, would bring an additional $1.2 trillion in income beyond what we make now. That's beyond that. Also, we stop all subsidies to all special industries, pharmaceutical, energy cartels, the tax depreciation allowance for gas companies or oil companies, big pharma, no more subsidies. That saves us an additional $335 billion. Now, if we just did those two things and had one simple flat income tax across the board, everybody pays it. Let's say 10% to 15%. That brings us in an additional $700 billion. So we've already raised $2 trillion without having to cut a single public program, Medicaid, Medicare. Nothing has to be touched except what we've been giving as a free check to get out of financial jail to corporate America because they own the legislators. It's a very corrupt process, all of our body politic, and the media and pundits to support it. This is a simple way to cut through all this. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours. Call us at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear from you now. Now let's go into studio New York City. We have a newsmaker guest coming up in about, 15 minutes. It'll be a short piece, but I'm going to get as many of your calls on as possible. Let's say hello to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Gary. Hello. We've got some great questions here. The first is from Mary from Dallas. She's concerned about the world we live in. She says there's so much going on and so little is being done to change the world, but she finds you and your views to be the most reasonable she's found anywhere, especially your approach on the radio, and wants to know what do you feel are the top 2-3 things that you feel should be done about the current problems, please.
Oh, current, which problems is she referring to?
The current problems in America, sorry.
All right, we have three, all limited to three. One, we should boycott all elections and not participate at all in the process of electing anyone because it's all corrupt. If you pull back and you choose not to watch any more debates, now it's Republicans, but then it'll be Democrats, then you're saying, I do not any longer allow you to be enabled by my mindless support, because the best and brightest are the most corrupt and vile and self-serving. We need regular Americans who understand what it is to be on the other end of any choice. Right now, there are two sets of laws. Those that are written that protect the wealthy and the powerful, and those who penalize or hold the rest of us to account. As a result, we have to have only one standard to live by that we all have to adhere to. How you get that is you take away the power of those to influence legislation that protects their interest. By that, you do number two. You ban all lobbying. No lobbying for anything at all. You make 100% of all lobbying illegal. Therefore, the 14,000 registered lobbyists, the 50,000 consultants who are not a registered lobbyist but come from Congress, the Congress that is a permanent Congress, meaning it used to come, you get elected, you'd work, and then you go back to your home. Now they stay because they can make 10 times more money serving the very people that they used to oversee. So you get rid of that, and then the only time you vote is when there's not a reform. Reform never works. There's always someone on the inside who will control the reform to benefit themselves. and the payoffs is just endemic. Just imagine Washington, D.C. is one giant toilet bowl that everyone is dumped in, and you're going to try to find the clean little piece of water to take a glass of water to drink. That's Washington. So yeah. Try to find me the honest politician, the honest bureaucrat, the caring person. Third is, so therefore, to finish that, so if we say the only elections allowed, federal, state, and local, no outside money allowed, nor can the person put a penny of their own money. It must come from one simple public flat tax. And that means every election cycle is only 3 months. Everybody fills out the same identical given form, which defines their background. Everything they want to say about themselves is put in there, plus a series of the most important relevant questions. They address those questions. Then we have a chance to read who they are, see something about them. They have video bios about them. So, and then we buy lottery, select people that we, the public, will then have a debate with, a question with. And then we will select others to debate each other. And then we do a series of, a very simple series of eliminations until we're right down to the final people. This way, a janitor, a school teacher, a cab driver, an unemployed actor could all work their unique skills and give their perspective, as well as a wealthy multimillionaire business person or a lawyer. So you've got to make the entire process by people getting into power for a single term, 3 years only, and they cannot work in any of those industries. Otherwise, the whole system stays corrupt. And lastly, we need to stop all of the subsidizing of special interest groups. That means the military-industrial spy complex. That's $1 trillion a year we could save. And if you look at all the other industries, they're getting special advantages because they have written laws to protect them and lobbyists to ensure money coming their ways. We could balance the budget and have zero debt. And as an extension of that, you eliminate the Federal Reserve, one of the most corrupt Nazi organizations in history. It is loathsome. It is a blight upon everyone's intellect once you understand how corrupt this organization is and how they are nothing more than a bank for the wealthy and powerful. By an extension of that, you stop our wars because you no longer have anyone who will profit from it. None of our wars have anything in the world to do with making America safer. You would have to be beyond naive to believe that. Our wars are about profiteering from the special interest groups, once again, who get in line with contracts knowing that there will be no oversight. They can have these rebooted every year and make massive amounts of profit. And if I were to add a fourth in, I would say get rid of 90% of all of the bureaucracies we currently have by reducing them down to functional size with input from the citizens. Meaning there is no more secrets. That's it. No more secrets. Every single thing that's done, every communication must be transparent with consumer oversight. Then you have a chance to have something that represents a democracy. Okay, hope that answers that question.
Yes, so many people, I'm sure, wish that would be the case. And the second thing here, we have lots of things, actually. Harold is retired. This is something very different. He doesn't listen to the radio, as he finds so much of it is just boring, he says. But he has come across you 2 years ago, and now this, he's very interested, obviously, and now it's an important part of his day, listening to your show at noon. He is 87. He's been remembering the days of the great dust bowls. He says that if today's youth knew about this phenomenon from the 1930s, they would certainly have a very different perspective on their respect for nature. What are your thoughts on the dust bowls, please?
I would back into the question. I would say if you were to take a youth in the United States and take them to any one of 12,000 villages and towns and small cities in China that today do not exist because the great deserts have overtaken them. The desertification of China is so rapid and so massive that one-fifth of the entire country is now desert, and it'll be half of the country if major efforts are not made. But they've done everything to destroy their natural resources, to alter those resources and exploit them for their ever-growing market-driven economy, about 10 to 12% per year for the last 20 years. and now they've created an unstoppable, insatiable upper middle class and middle class consumer who wants everything that we have. And to do that, you have to have resources. The resources in China have been exploited, so now they're going into Africa and South America and leasing or buying large tracts of land to exploit them, creating dust bowls everywhere they go. Because when all you do is look to extract something from the soil and put nothing back, then your thought is short-term gain but not long-term sustainability. So if you showed someone the consequences of living in a village that was there for 1,000 years and in the last 5 years simply is now a desert, the tops of houses are all that you might see, that brings a reality. Now then in the United States, first it started with the winter wheat and then the red wheat. But it happened when we went through one of the biggest booms in agriculture, post-industrial revolution from 1880 to about 1920. We had prosperity. Why? Because the family farmer that used to be completely self-sufficient, the family farmer would have maybe 50 different types of apples and peaches and nectarines, nut trees. They would have a dairy barn where they'd have cheeses that would be wrapped and sealed in wax that they could eat for years. They would have everything they needed to sustain themselves, members of their community, for a long period of time. Then in came the mechanization, said, why should you work so hard to grow 100 different types of vegetables and fruits and just grow wheat? And we'll buy that wheat. We'll guarantee you per bushel. And we'll give you a mechanized way of harvesting this wheat. And they did. And now it changed the way that farmers did business. And they didn't replenish the soil. They didn't rest the soil. They didn't grow green winter crops. So then in the spring, when the fall came and the ground started to split, the water didn't carry the topsoil off. So the Great Dust Bowl was 10 years. It was in Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico. 8 tons of good soil were blown away per acre. Then they had in 1931 what was called the Black Blizzard. And there were record harvests and then destruction. The land had been green and lush and fertile. Now it wasn't. And people didn't realize that as the rain stopped, and they did in 1931, the wheat withered. And people then started having to, for the first time, wear dust masks. It takes 1,000 years to build 1 inch of topsoil. 1 year to blow it all away. 100 million acres in 5 states where farming is done was destroyed. And they had as many as 35 major dust storms per year. Now, you have to understand a dust storm creates static electricity from the storms. That kills all your wheat. And so people literally had to live off charity, canned foods. The New Deal was just getting in, but most farmers didn't want any handouts. The American farmer didn't want someone to feed them or their family. So then in 1934, the government paid $16 per cow to kill the cows, and they killed the vast majority of all the cows in the United States in that area because there was no corn to feed them. And then in 1935 came a plague of jackrabbits. They came out of the hill country because there was nothing to eat because of the drought, and they ate everything else. And then you had what was called Black Sunday. That was April 1935. There was 27 straight days where there was so much dust that no matter what direction you looked, all you could see is black.
Wow.
And it created a whole new phenomena called dust pneumonia. And 1/4 of the entire population in 6 states simply left. They migrated. And then in 1936, the first dust storm in the United States hit the East Coast for the first time. And that's when people in Washington paid attention to it. And until that time, they really hadn't. And then in 1937, the government began a new method of helping people. If they went back to the land, they'd give them $1 an acre to work the land under new tilling techniques. And and then they started putting in the irrigation systems, and then they subsidized the people in their plantings, and that's what caused that reversal. But that lasted for a full 10 years. That was man-made, not nature-made. And we're doing it again in South America. We're doing a lush, perfect rainforest in Brazil. One-fourth of it is now desert with dust storms. And if the youth today saw around the world the consequences of selfish farming, they would change their ways, I believe.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you.
Okay, let's go over and say hello now to Lou from Miami. Hi, Lou. You're on.
Yeah, hi, Gary. I have a question about how your flat tax would apply to businesses. Because I'm old enough to remember when New York City had a gross receipts tax, and it sounds like your flat tax would be a gross receipts tax on business.
It's not. It's not a gross tax. It is a tax before taxes, meaning you take all your profits, your gross profit, you take all of your expenses, and what you have left would be what you normally pay taxes on, your taxable income. The difference is, instead of being able to have a tax allowance or write it off in some way that is based upon the uniqueness of your accounting skills, instead you would pay a flat tax on your taxable income, not your gross income.
Okay. All right. That's much better, because it wasn't clear to me that it wasn't a gross receipts tax.
It's not a gross receipts tax. No, that would not be fair.
Yeah, you still have lots of issues, though, as to what's an allowable deduction.
I understand, but you reform it so that you have any legitimate business expense within it. But what the corporations do, they will buy other businesses that lose money simply to offset the profit they make from their core business.
So, right, and you'll still have the issue, you know, most of these big corporations are saving taxes by, you know, what people in the business call transfer pricing.
Correct, but you eliminate that by having one tax for everyone, including on every single Wall Street transaction, including your algorithm transactions, with 71% of all the transactions, on all hedge funds, on all equity partnerships, on all transfer fees, and all derivative positions, and all other forms of tranching. You pay the same identical tax. Watch how that changes the entire way corporate America makes its money. What it does, it means they can make their profit. They just won't be gouging profit. They'll be paying a fair share. That then means that the money we need for infrastructure repair, for a single payer insurance, and for many of the other things will be present. Without this major modification, it does not limit people in making an honest profit. What it does, it prevents people from going from an honest profit to a deceptive profit. And much of the corporate America makes a deceptive profit.
I certainly agree with the concept, though the problem with transfer taxing pricing will remain, because if you have a company like General Electric and it owns 40% of some foreign company that produces something it buys from it, you know, then the question is, are all the profits of that foreign company included in General Electric's profit for purpose of tax?
Yes, they are. That's the fee you pay for outsourcing jobs from the United States to another company just to exploit the cheap labor, so you do not have to pay a living wage in the United States. If some corporation is not willing to honor the fact that they have a responsibility to Americans of all backgrounds to give American a chance of making a living wage, and instead are exploiting with malice aforethought the low labor market, the low cost of labor in other massive labor markets, then that's a very selfish, predatory person and corporation, and they should not be allowed to make those profits without paying a tax on it.
Okay, Gary, thank you for clearing up my confusion.
Happy to help you, Lou. Thank you very much from Miami.
Bye.
Now we're going over and say hello to my guest who is standing by in just a moment. Please stay with us. We'll be back.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway, the hip parade and ballyhoo. The lullaby of Broadway, the
rumble of the subway train, the rattle of the taxi, the daffodils who entertain at Antidote's and Maxine's when the Broadway baby says goodnight. It's early in the morning. Manhattan babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. Good night, baby. Good night.
I'd like to welcome you all. I'm Gary Knoll. We've had a little challenge here getting my guest. I don't believe he's on yet. When we get my guest, we'll go right to him. We've been trying for about 10 minutes. We'll go back in studio and continue with questions that that Elizabeth has, and anyone else who would like to call and share their points of view on this larger tax issue, please do. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Elizabeth?
Hello.
You have a bunch of questions from people. I've answered a few. We'll take a few more if we're able to get our guests who we're trying. Good. If not, then we have no shortage of questions.
Okay. Hello. Yes. This is from Richard of New Orleans. He says he recently was forced to move out of his home and go and live with his brother. He lost his job. He says he's not a deadbeat. He's not a man who wants something for nothing, but he just can't find anything in his area of expertise since losing his job. He's just become aware of the fact that his brother lives with a very small footprint. And he says he feels it's very important. Could you please discuss why it is important for everybody in America to pay attention to our footprint, please?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
All right, first, understand what a footprint is. A footprint is that if you were to walk through this world, what would be the consequences to the environment, to the food that we consume, to the resources we have? If we have a finite amount of resources in the world, shouldn't our footprint, meaning how strong is our print on that, how much do we use, shouldn't that be something that we consider important? Now, the world as we know it is about 3.8 billion years old. There's about 7 billion people who have an impact. Those in less developed cultures have the least impact. The average life expectancy is about 77.9 years. Now, we only have 17% of the world that is considered wilderness. The 83% we strongly impact. And we have about 312 million Americans. If you just take a look at from the earliest, you spend about 2.5 years in diapers. Do you have any idea that most diapers today are disposable? Well, you're going to use around 3,800 diapers in that average baby. And it takes crude oil to make those diapers. When you look at how much crude oil it takes for the average baby to use just the average 3,800 diapers, it's about almost 1,900 gallons. You're going to use almost 700 pounds, I'm rounding it off, it's actually 715 pounds of plastic. You'll have 4.5 trees, the pulp of those trees, to make the products needed for that baby in those diapers. We're using 18 billion diapers per year. How long does it take a diaper to biodegrade out in the ocean or in the water or landfill? 500 years. It takes 22,000 gallons of water to wash a baby diaper in that baby's lifespan of wearing diapers per year. The first year, we're using an enormous amount of dairy. We have 65,000 dairy farms in the United States. That causes methane gas. That leads to global warming. Each one of those is going to consume about 100 pounds of grains to make the dairy on a regular basis. We have 9 million cows. In Louisiana, they set 20 million acres aside for consuming products that come from livestock. So look at the chickens. The average person eats 1,400 chickens, and that's an awful lot of chickens. That's approximately 2.5 tons per person. We consume 210 million eggs per day in the United States. That's 76 billion eggs in your lifetime. There's 255 eggs per year. That's 1.3 tons per person. I mean, and then look at the carbohydrates. Look at the potatoes. We average about 9,900 pounds per person per lifetime. That's 4 tons. Look at the bread and pizzas. We're eating about 4,000 loaves of bread. We're having about 87,000 slices of bread per person in our lifetime. We're having 4 billion hot dogs per year. That's about 5,400 per person in your lifetime, about 47 billion hamburgers per year. Mm-hmm. And when you're starting to look at each one of these, we eat 20 pounds of candy per year. We eat 14,000 candy bars in our lifetime. We have 1,056 pounds of sugar minimum in our lifetime. We're eating 11,000 apples in our lifetime and about 11 million bananas per day. So you start adding all this up of how much we actually consume. And then suddenly, gee whiz, you start realizing, yeah, I didn't know. You know, you mean everything I ship that's wrapped in plastic? Yeah. We use 29,000 pounds or 15 tons of plastic per person in our lifetime in soft drinks from aluminum cans. Where do you think that aluminum goes?
Yeah.
So we are massively consuming. Do we pay attention to where it comes from, what it causes, is it sustainable, and what can we do to lessen this? And that's why this whole movement, this whole idea is when we get off the grid, we disconnect from the standard footprint. We use less resources. We are far more biodynamic. We are more ecologically conscious. We make choices that do not cause burdens to the rest of the environment. And therefore, we lessen our footprint. Just look at your clothes. I mean, we spend $1,000 a year per person in the United States. We buy 40 pieces of clothes per year. We throw out 68 pounds of clothes per year. We travel 14,000 miles per year. I mean, we have so many things we do, and we don't think about the cost to it. I don't want to go further because I was just notified my guest is on the line, but I hope that gives you an idea that the larger picture, be aware, we are consumers.
Don't
now,
agree.
We've gotten our guest finally on the line, so let's go over there with the time remaining and say hello to Jim Gerritsen. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Jim, you are helping to lead a lawsuit on behalf of 270,000 organic and family farmers against Monsanto's patent claims for GMO seeds. Could you address this lawsuit, its significance, and what kind of obstacles or backlashes from Monsanto, including personal experiences, either you or other farmers, because of this lawsuit?
Well, we filed the lawsuit back in March, and if I may offer one correction, we have about 275,000 members in our plaintiff group of 83, and included within that number, there are several thousand certified organic farmers. And the plaintiff group is comprised of individual family farmers, independent seed companies, and agricultural groups. And the two primary goals that we're trying to achieve with the lawsuit is that we're challenging the validity of Monsanto's transgenic or GMO patents. We feel that they fail to meet the requirements of patent law, and we've got our patent lawyer will be Daniel Ravisher from the Public Patent Foundation in Manhattan, and he'll be making four legal arguments in court, and maybe the prominent one is the fact that GMO patents fail to meet the social utility requirement of patent law. So one of the things we're doing, one of the goals, is that we're challenging the very validity of the GMO patents as granted by the Patent Office. And the other situation is a preemptive action trying to provide court protection for family farmers that right now, if we should become contaminated by Monsanto seed, we are in the perverse situation of, because of that contamination, the view from Monsanto is that we are in possession of their technology and have not paid royalty on it, and we are open to a patent infringement lawsuit, despite the fact that GMOs have absolutely no place in the organic community. We don't want GMOs. We certainly don't want contamination. We think that they should keep their pollution on their side of the fence. So we're seeking protection from the court so that we do not have to defend ourselves in patent infringement cases should we become contaminated.
Where do you stand in the legal process?
We're going through pretrial motions at this point. Monsanto has a pattern of delaying lawsuits as long as they can, hoping that their opposition will run out of resources. So stalling techniques are very much the norm in this kind of a thing. But we're prepared for this action to take 3 to 5 years to work its way through court, and we think that we have a very strong case.
All right. Now, any thoughts on the sustainability of our produce production in terms of industrial farming versus smaller farm models? And in fact, I don't know how familiar you are with it, but speak on the populist movement of the late 1800s and American farm economist Carl Wilkin in the 1930s, who created the model known as the farm parity, which argued from the restriction of large farm sizes for a proper agricultural economy.
Well, I've read, as maybe you have, the book entitled Unforgiven by Charles Walters, where they talk about Carl Wilkin and his concept on farm parity and the need to basically have balance within the economy, to where the farm sector, which is one of the primary natural resource producers, they need to be paid full parity or fair price for their product to allow for sufficient wealth to be inserted into the economy. And we have been in a position of declining crop prices really going back 50 or 60 years, so that the amount that farmers are able to sell their crops for has not kept up with the cost of machinery and the hiring of labor and those different input factors. But there was an interesting study released rather recently by the United Nations talking about how are we going to feed the increasing world population, and it was a very significant landmark study. And they indicated that agroecology, or ecological or organic farming, is the wave of the future, that particularly in the lesser developed countries, that these are the techniques that are going to feed people, and it is certainly not going to be genetically modified seed, where the farmers have to change the many thousand-year-old tradition of saving a portion of their crop to replant the next year. When it comes to GMO or a transgenic seed, they're forced to buy from the multinational corporation new seed every spring, and this is very problematic for a large percent of the world's population that are subsistence farmers earning just a few hundred dollars per year.
Okay, what can we, the public, do, knowing that our legislators, especially those involved on committees and committee chairpersons, that are overseeing USDA policies and FDA policies, they're already in the pocket. The lobbyists have bought them. They're not going to hold any allegiance to the American public. What can we do, knowing how uneven the playing field is, to stop genetic engineering and to make sure that organic and small family farmers have a chance to exist and even thrive?
Every day, people vote with their dollars. Where they spend their dollars, they're casting a vote for what they support. So I'd encourage everyone to go out of your way to buy organic produce grown by family-scale farmers and reject the attempted inroads into the marketplace. For example, Monsanto is trying to introduce a genetically modified sweet corn into the marketplace. This is going on right now, and there's a large resistance that is developing, but let your produce manager know that you will not buy corn that is genetically modified, that you want organic produce, and so spend that money on a daily basis. Vote with your pocketbook. Obviously, when the election time comes around, vote to support candidates that are going to stand up for the planet and for good eating and good healthy food, but every day we have that opportunity in a democracy of spending our money and supporting the institutions and the scale of, in this case, the scale of agriculture that we truly believe is going to be the solution for many of the problems in our society, including health problems.
Jerry, Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate all your good work. We will keep up to date with what you're doing, and the website is woodprairie.com. My guest, Jim Gerritsen, G-E-R-R-I-T-S-E-N. All the best to you in the movement, Jim.
Thank you, Gary.
We're out of time. That was our newsmaker update. So we are I'm a certified organic farmer. I'm part of this. We are fighting back. We are 270,000 family farmers, gardeners, and consumers against Monsanto. And defending Monsanto are the best legislators money can buy. So we have to be honest about what we're dealing with. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.
The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're going to the promised land.